Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leader in obesity medicine.
A 64-year-old female presents for obesity treatment. She relates a healthy diet combined with intermittent fasting, and a late lunch, and nothing afterwards. She's physically active with greater than 150 minutes of moderately vigorous activity per week. She denies food cravings, binge eating, or other unhealthy behaviors, yet she's unable to lose weight. For some patients, understanding why they have obesity can be a mystery. In taking a history of lifestyle habits, their dietary intake seems healthy and appropriate. They engage in regular physical activity, meeting guideline recommendations, and they have healthy sleep habits and do not demonstrate emotional eating behaviors. In calculating their energy intake and energy expenditure, they appear to be in a negative energy balance, yet they have persistent weight gain and obesity. Their weight is disproportionate to their caloric intake and their lifestyle habits. There are a wide variety of things that can alter our response to energy balance: thyroid disease, genetic disorders, lipedema, gut microbiome, social determinants of health, high stress, poor sleep, mood disorders, and weight cycling can all complicate the energy balance calculation. Other factors to consider is exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals. Of note, in the case presented here, she frequently eats frozen meals that she heats by microwave. Endocrine-disrupting chemicals are ubiquitous in our environment and warrant consideration of the evaluation of obesity and its causes. Hi, I'm Dr. Nick Pennings, Chair of Family Medicine of the Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine and Executive Director of Clinical Education for the Obesity Medicine Association. And with me today to talk about endocrine-disrupting chemicals is Lydia Alexander, MD. Dr. Alexander presented a lecture titled Endocrine Disruptors and Their Impact on Obesity at the 2024 OMA Annual Conference in Denver, Colorado. Dr. Alexander was also inducted as the president of the Obesity Medicine Association at that conference. Dr. Alexander, welcome and tell us some more about yourself.
Good morning, good afternoon. Thank you for having me on the podcast, Nick. I'm based out of the Northern California area. I'm the chief medical officer for a company called Inara Health, which focuses on obesity care. And I'm also, as you mentioned, the current president of the Obesity Medicine Association. I'm really passionate about advancing the knowledge and to our healthcare providers around caring for patients with obesity, given that 75% of our United States population is having some sort of weight issue, and it's usually the root cause of many of the other chronic conditions we treat in primary care.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And one of the interesting things that you spoke about at the conference was the endocrine disrupting chemicals. So what are they? What are some of the most common types of these chemicals that we're exposed to?
Sure. So Nick, that's such a great question. And endocrine disrupting chemicals, EDCs for short, are really substances in our environment that interfere with our hormonal systems. They can mimic, block, or alter the function of hormones. And what happens is that they disrupt processes like metabolism, reproduction, and growth. Common types of EDCs include phthalates, often found in plastics and our personal care products, bisphosphonols like BPA, BPS, and canned goods, pesticides, and flame retardants in household products. Those are just a few examples of different types of EDCs, but they do highlight how pervasive EDCs are in our everyday lives. They are in our nonstick cookware, water-repellent clothing, stain-resistant fabrics and carpets, as I mentioned, cosmetics. And thinking about it as I was preparing for this lecture and in the work I do informing patients in terms of best practices around nutrition, physical activity in our built environment, and different types of behaviors, it became clear to me that this was such a fascinating, interesting topic, very relevant to the work that we do.
So you mentioned a couple of sources. What does packaging and plastics and food storage containers, how do they impact exposure to EDCs?
The way that they impact that is that different types of chemicals are used to make the plastics that we employ, for instance, to package, to wrap meat, takeaway containers when we order takeout food, and in packaging, for instance, for energy bars and so forth. And so these often have different chemicals in them, like DEHP, DINP, and a whole bunch of others that are used to create stability for the plastic, to make it more bendy or foldable. But those, since they're touching the food, they can leach into it. And where we store the food very much matters. Leaving, for instance, a plastic water bottle in direct sunlight in our car, or food that is covered by plastic, will accelerate this transfer of these chemicals. And BPA, as an example, is classified as a xenoestrogen because of its similarity with diethylstilbestrol. That's a mouthful, DES for short, and a synthetic estrogen. And as an EDC, it enhances the estrogen receptor pathway. And so it has been one of the world's most heavily produced synthetic industrial chemicals. And was banned a couple decades ago in baby products and baby bottles and so forth. But different types of BPAs are still ubiquitous in our lives. BPF, BPS, and still can have an impact in terms of contaminating our food source and predisposing to weight issues.
And in the case I mentioned, the person microwaved their food in plastic containers, does that increase the exposure?
Yes, it certainly does. EDCs that are microwaved because of the increasing sort of the molecular activity of those particles will certainly increase the transfer of those chemicals into the foods.
And you mentioned that these agents, these EDCs, affect hormonal pathways. How does that contribute to obesity?
Well, the way it contributes to obesity, there are a couple different mechanisms of action for how EDCs work. For one, they can mimic natural hormones. They can also antagonize the action of natural hormones. They can even alter the pattern of synthesis and metabolism, or modify expression of specific receptors. So you can have sort of an over response, an under response, an inhibited response. There are a lot of different ways that these work. But when that happens, an EDC, which is an obesogen, which is an endocrine disrupting chemical that is involved in obesity, can affect the physiology of obesity and create a pathologic state. So for instance, the PPAR gamma activation of this particular receptor can result in increased number of and size of adipocytes. And it can also lead to alterations in stem cells. So in animal and human studies, this has been witnessed. And the way then that some obesogens work is they increase the number of fat cells, they can increase the size of fat cells, and as mentioned, they can alter endocrine regulation of adipose tissue development. When this happens, this alters hormones, the hormones that we know are relevant to regulating hunger and satiety, and as well as food preference. And so this can, and they can also alter basic metabolic rates. So there, multiple different ways in which EDCs and specifically obesogens can alter the physiology of weight regulation and create weight dysregulation.
And what about cytokines? Do they increase inflammatory responses in the adipocytes?
The inflammatory responses are part of the pathways for EDCs and obesogens as well, being a subset of EDCs. And there are, increased inflammation in the body is definitely one way, especially as it impacts the hypothalamus, that EDCs and obesogens, again, specifically can be disruptive. And we know that there are, some components of cellular and molecular pathways involved in adipogenesis, such as the 3T3L cell line, pre-adipocytes in general, the L1 cells, that obesogens can disrupt the way that they mature into adipocytes under certain conditions. And we know that RXR, which is the retinoid X receptor, is another nuclear receptor that interacts with PPAR gamma. And this regulates the expression of genes involved in fat storage, lipid metabolism, and energy homeostasis. And so overactivation of RXR in conjunction with PPAR gamma can enhance fat storage and adipogenesis, and this can lead to increased adipose tissue and obesity. And so different EDCs, as they, let's say, insult our body, cause an inflammatory response to the body, and inflammation in the hypothalamus, inflammation in the gut, so the gastrointestinal tract. Some very specific ways this can happen. Another very common obesogen is that's being looked at right now and is ubiquitous in many of the as an additive, as an emulsifier, is PS80, polysorbate 80. We can often find that in many of the different fiber supplements, as an example, that are out there in the market. And in rodent studies, this has been shown to create inflammation and release cytokines in the GI tract.
And so all these things, the net effect is for them to facilitate triglyceride storage in adipocyte and just promote adipocyte growth, formation and growth.
Yes, exactly. So they it can increase the number or increase the size of adipocytes, and then also dysregulate the way in which our hunger and satiety system interacts with environmental stimuli as well. So with in the classic change in the weight set point, the way that the hypothalamus becomes inflamed and dysregulates, I'd say it's in a sense somewhat similar to the thyroid. There's inflammation of the central systems, and then they have central and then peripheral effects. And so there's so many different multiple ways in which obesogens interact with people and with all the different processes within people. And I would say that this is especially important, and we see it happen even more concerningly when there is a lot of during development, so fetal development, in children who are growing and changing much more quickly than adults in different types of situations like that too. This can be even more concerning.
So periods of growth, you're saying, would be particularly concerning. I would imagine puberty too would be another time of great concern.
Absolutely.
That's very interesting. So it's Completely avoiding these agents is virtually impossible in today's world because they're so ubiquitous. What are some important things that people can do to help minimize their exposure to EDCs?
Yeah, so that in the work that I did, I went down many of these different rabbit holes in terms of the different receptors and how it affects our weight physiology and so forth. And I thought, okay, from a practical standpoint, what can we do to make some progress here? Because we can make ourselves completely OCD thinking about how can I remove all these different, endocrine disrupting chemicals, which could be affecting my weight and my health in so many different ways from the environment. And that's probably not great from a mental health standpoint. It's probably not great from a stress response standpoint. And I'm not sure getting OCD about it, at least for me, led to improved health. But I think taking, small, manageable, steps, and slowly changing our built environment or, our daily environment over time can be really helpful and important. So for instance, using glass, stainless steel or silicon containers instead of plastic containers for food storage, I think is important. I know for myself, as an example, trying to create more time in the day, I would use disposable plastic containers, but I wouldn't dispose them because I don't want to have the environmental impact. I would heat the food in there quickly because it was a lot of work to plate it and, do all this sort of thing. I just wanted to heat it at work and eat the food. And so I just started changing things a little bit and thinking, okay, how about I start using storage containers for my food, drink from a stainless steel water bottle. I'm also opting for fresh or frozen foods rather than canned goods whenever that's possible, I think is really important. Definitely avoiding microwaving food in plastic containers is a bit of low-hanging fruit there. And then choosing personal care products labeled as phthalate-free or paraben-free is also a great step to take. The sunscreens that are zinc-based can be another important change to make. And then reducing exposure to pesticides by washing produce thoroughly or choosing organic whenever it's possible can help. So if there's a peel and you can peel it, maybe you could save money and not go organic there. But if there's something else such as berries and other vegetables and fruits that you will be eating the skin, choosing organic and then also washing produce thoroughly can remove pesticide residues. So a few things that I do is, and there are some studies here that sort of, I ask myself, well, how should I be washing produce? How should I best be washing and storing produce? And so glass containers, check. And then in terms of washing, what's effective? And really either having something that is a bit acidic or a bit basic can be highly effective. So 10% acetic acid or 10% sodium chloride. My go-to tends to be putting baking soda in some water and putting fruits and vegetables in there and letting them soak. It's in the morning when I'm in a rush, that kind of ends up being a bit hard to do. So I'll prep ahead of time and soak the kids' vegetables and fruits in there and then have them ready to go in the morning to sort of cut down on that sort of time. But grapes, strawberries, tomatoes, apples, all of those, I'll either spray with a solution that I've made up like that with either vinegar or baking soda. And I'll let them soak for at least 15 minutes. Studies have shown that more than 15 minutes, there's no additional benefit, but But up to 15 minutes of soaking can really remove a lot of the pesticides.
Does that alter the taste of the foods at all? The sodium in the baking soda, or does that alter their taste?
It can if you get a little too excessive about it, I found. I found that through trial and error. So, you know, it's kind of like plant food. A little bit is great for the plants. And then you're just like, well, maybe a little bit more would be extra great for the plants. And it's really not. This is kind of the same idea a little goes a long way. And also there are commercial products that, you know, that will have this in there. Another one I get on Amazon, not being paid as a sponsor here, but, you know, some types of, I'll make a generic vegetable wash. So something that's called vegetable wash can be an easy way to go to if you're not sure how to do this and you don't want your kids thinking that you've made everything taste undelicious and that they're not going to eat fruits and vegetables for a while because of that. So those are, you know, those are some quick ways that I think about, you know, changing my built environment and reducing the touch points for endocrine disrupting chemicals in the environment. The same with cleaning products. So, you know, anytime you can find something that's a little bit more natural, to clean. I'm again a big proponent of baking soda, and my kids laugh because my answer to everything is baking soda. Have a stain on your t-shirt, it's baking soda. But you found some ants in the pantry, let's put some baking soda on it. And
it reminds me of my big fat Greek wedding where everything is Windex, right?
And being Greek, that's exactly what they say. They say, Mom, is this your Windex? And I think it actually is.
Oh, that's funny. I know I'm much more vigilant about only microwaving in glass containers in particular, and storing in glass whenever I can. But even the products you buy are, you know, vinegar or those types of things come in plastic containers. So does that pose a risk as well?
It actually does, unfortunately. And there were some studies around that looking to see over time, even if even if those containers weren't heated, what exactly happened. There was a study by Yang around phthalate migration. And so they looked at, phthalates leaching out into foods depending on the length of storage time, the temperature, the fat content, the acidity, the light exposure. There was a lot going on there, and it was really fascinating. And they looked at a bean, just some type of cake, potato, and fish, and they found that, yeah, if you had, you know, if you were storing, you know, storing any of these types of, you know, any of these foods, they looked at all different types of foods that, you know, because some of these are, you know, I guess more acidic or have a higher fat content than others, and that over, you know, the course of a month, 3 months, and even, you know, 6 months, that EDCs did transfer into those different foods. And this is because phthalates don't form strong covalent bonds with plastic polymers. And so they're just kind of available over time to just let go of their bond with the plastic polymer and decide to bond to your bean or your cake or your potato or your fish. So, so that kind of, you know, that that's another, you know, another way to think about it. So I have made the change twofold. One is that, for instance, if I'm buying honey, I, as an example, or any, you know, type of food that comes in a package like that, I will look to see, can I find a glass container? And can I buy that? And if the cost difference is very prohibitive, I may still buy the plastic. I know, for instance, honey at Costco comes in these three bears, and they're plastic, and it's a great deal. And I like honey and maple syrup because it's the most minimally processed type of, you know, sweetener out there. And buying honey in glass jars can get expensive from you know, from the different, you know, sort of curated high-end places. But you, as soon as you get it home, you can immediately remove it, put it in a glass container if that's the best you can do. And I do save different glass containers from, you know, or mason jars, and I put, you know, I put in store foods in there.
All right. Well, those are some very helpful tips to try to reduce our exposure to these endocrine disrupting chemicals. So lastly, this is a question I always like to ask when discussing obesity treatment with other healthcare providers. What's your favorite bit of advice?
Oh, that is such a good question. I would want healthcare providers to keep the concept of obesity care at the heart of their patient interactions. Weight loss is just one factor, and it's sort of the, you know, the I guess the sexy factor of what we do, or is very commercialized, where everyone talks about the weight change or the weight loss, and not the whole journey. And so I would love to, you know, to talk about the concept of obesity care, and that it often, it's often the place where patients, as I mentioned, healthcare providers and media focus on the most, but really the most important aspect of obesity care is maintaining the weight lost over a long period of time to achieve health goals. And our bodies work to defend our weight set point. And if there's dysregulation, the body is choosing a set point that's way too high for us. So once we've made all those strides and gotten to a healthier weight, and so many of the different chronic conditions that are associated with excess weight or excess adiposity have improved, then our body starts to push us back up. And it's very frustrating to patients, to providers, and it can feel as though it's our fault, this loss of willpower. And so taking the long view and thinking of weight change or weight loss as part A, and then actively maintaining that weight over time as part B, and really the holy grail. And that's where we really should have our focus. I think of this as sort of the pregnancy and raising the child. Pregnancy is kind of that fun, you know, sexy part where everyone's like, oh, you're glowing, you're so cute, it's wonderful. And then the baby's born. And then now you've got the rest of your life, you know, with a child that you are responsible for, or at least until the age of 18, I guess, and need to raise. And that's where the rubber hits the road. And so I would want to tell healthcare providers that once somebody reaches their, you know, a goal weight or a healthier weight, that's the beginning of the journey, not the end of the journey.
And I think that's a common misconception by both healthcare providers and patients alike, that the hard part is losing the weight and then maintenance should be easy. And it's really the other way around.
Exactly. Exactly. And that, and I think as the Nick is, this is sort of what we do. This is, you know, the Kool-Aid that we drink every day. And it seems rather elementary, but it's really not. When, you know, when I talk to others and I hear, you know, I hear how society in general is thinking about weight, and that it's even called weight loss is telling us something. And so obesity care and healthful weight are words that I love to use mm-hmm. to start to shift the conversation to giving obesity care the medical home that it deserves and the medical care that it deserves.
Well, thank you, Lydia. You can find Dr. Alexander's conference lecture, Endocrine Disruptors and Their Impact on Obesity, in the OMA Academy. Where else can listeners learn about your work?
They can visit www.anarahealth.com, spelled E-N-A-R-A, health.com. Additionally, my Instagram and LinkedIn pages, which are accessible just by knowing my name, Lydia Alexander or Dr. Lydia on Instagram.
Awesome. Well, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
If you like this podcast, please share it with a friend and help the OMA as we strive to advance clinicians' understanding of the disease of obesity.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Obesity, a Disease. For more information about Obesity Medicine podcasts and other valuable resources from the clinical leaders in obesity medicine, please visit www.obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode and want to listen regularly, head over to iTunes where you can subscribe, rate, and leave us a much appreciated review. The views expressed in this episode are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please join us again for our next episode of Obesity, a Disease.